But tonight I'm really happy to have a raft of excellent writers here, and they will be reading from the Sonoma County Writing Practice Anthology called Hair Pieces, and Margaret Chaminski Shapiro, teacher, writer, and editor of Hair Pieces, will be the MC for tonight. Thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for hosting us tonight. This is just a splendid venue for us. It's just perfect. And this is, I was just telling Jim, this is sort of winding us through one whole year's cycle, because the book was delivered to us in November of 2008. And now it's October of 2009. So thank you very much for that. It feels synchronistic. So let's see where to begin. We are a raft of writers. We love to write, probably more than just about anything else. And I have been known to say, and I'll say it early on tonight, once we get going at these readings, I kind of get into such a space that I can go all night. So it's always good that we have a time boundary that cuts us off, because once I get going, I lose my head and come to my writing senses. So welcome, everyone. It's great to see everyone here. I'm Margaret Kaminsky Shapiro, and this is Hair Pieces. So tonight we're going to read from the book, and I would also like us to write tonight, if everyone is so willing. It would be wonderful if we could take some minutes to write together after we've read and see what comes from a jump-off line. Hi, come on in, welcome. So we write generally from a jump-off line in kind of 10-minute segments or so. We write fast. We don't worry about any kind of editing. We don't worry about punctuation. We don't worry about spelling. What we're doing is we're building pages, not judgments. So we leave our editors hopefully someplace where they're not going to get us for a long time, and we jump in with a jump-off line that just comes straight out of our arm. A lot of it is memoir, and we tap into a lot of memories that are sometimes very touching, very, very poignant, very powerful. And then we read. We read from the raw copy that we've just written. So it's really about letting go. It's about just letting go of what you've written and speaking it out. We give recall, not critiquing. And that's just letting the reader know where their piece touches us. So we become different kinds of listeners, too. We listen purely for the musicality of the words. I had two wonderful women who helped me very, very strongly and in a committed way. Nan is here tonight. Nan Koons helped put this together along with Marie Galetta. And it was an incredible amount of work, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful journey. And then I want to also thank all the writers who've come tonight. It's good to see everyone. So I'll start. I'm going to read two pieces, and then we'll rotate through and each read two pieces, either of our own or of somebody else's. And I'm going to start with one called I Remember, a South African memoir of summer in December. I remember summer at the Cutty Sark Hotel, where the immaculate lawns, emerald green and glowing, sprawled out from the edge of the old black and white colonial building. It was December, and the hotel became home to vacationers from Salisbury, Bulawayo, Johannesburg, and Pretoria. The bronzed bodies of the women would glide into the expansive lounge for evening cocktails, wearing their brightly colored silk sarong skirts, high-heeled and strapped sandals, and exotic French perfumes that would linger in the sea air as they passed by. The men would gloss their hair into a shimmer and would dab a subtle dose of Old Spice aftershave on their cleanly shaven chins. The men wore neatly pressed white or ecru cotton safari suits with white handkerchiefs politely poking out of jacket pockets. They would cloak their necks in proper English cravats. I remember the cocktail lounge, where the exotically turbaned Indian waiters would serve exquisitely fashioned drinks in tall glasses decorated with maraschino cherries, tiny colored parasols, and bright toothpicks. I remember the cocktail lounge piano player, who sat erect in his black suit and white shirt with feet neatly positioned on the foot pedals. He kept a thick glass ashtray next to his right hand, which he filled with grey ash and cigarette butts. It intermittently would be removed and cleaned by a passing waiter. I remember that he smoked between Sinatra love tunes. I remember that the piano player dressed up as Santa Claus each year and visited the children's dining room in the middle of the South African summer. He would be adorned in a red cloak, white fur-lined hat, cotton batting beard, thick black plastic belt, and shorts which revealed muscular tanned legs. I remember being impressed with the great streams and rivulets of perspiration that glided down his forehead and cheeks, then disappeared behind his beard. I remember the woven straw fans that hung from the ceiling of the dining room at the Cutty Sark. They swung back and forth, languid yet eternally hopeful. I remember the heavy humidity and the heat that hung in the air despite the fans, despite the sporadic sea breeze. I remember Christmas dinner and the heavy desserts filled with dried fruit, spicy liqueurs, and silver tickies and sixpences that clinked between our teeth with each bite. The ultimate fear, I remember, was the possibility of swallowing the money. And then I'm going to read a poem I wrote called Pen on Fire. She's on fire, I tell you. The girl got herself a pen and now she's on fire. Her clothes hang limply on the bedroom chair, her earrings, the beloveds, forgotten in the hidden drawer. She's on fire, I tell you. She wants to change the world one word at a time. She is mighty, she is hot, her poems will singe your skin, so don't get too close, watch where you walk. She's on fire, I tell you, in all the back alleys, behind the warlords' houses, she is sitting pen in hand, page at the ready. Some say even her notebooks are singed at the edges. She's on fire, I tell you, she salsas in her tight red dress, the one with the scalloped hem kicking up her heels on pointed black stilettos, while the drummer's eyes reflect her fire, while his beat reflects her heart. She's on fire, I tell you. In her prison cell, she is writing her name on the walls, scarring the bricks with her image, tearing the mortar with her fingernails. Beware when she is free. She's on fire, I tell you. That poet in her wants to write, wants to spill the beans, wants to thread the needle, wants to pull the trigger, wants to push the pedal. That poet in her wants to steal the line, paint the picture, pour the hot oil. She's on fire, I tell you. Watch out for those red fingernails, that hot jive, those luscious lips. She's on fire. And if you get too close, you just might burn and love it. Okay, so, Bonnie, would you announce yourself and sure. read us two pieces?
Okay. Great. Hi, I'm Bonnie Bruinslot, and I have been getting published, which is so exciting. With somebody else here, I think, has been in the Best Women Travel Writing 2009 by Traveler's Tales and the Christian Science Monitor. And it all started by going to Margaret's class. Mm-hmm. So it's been really fun. Tonight I'm going to read what was like it came to me when I was thinking about my first son. My first son was killed in an automobile accident when he was 18. And this describes how I was feeling. And Margaret asked if she could put it in here, and I was very flattered, actually. And I'll read that, and then I'm going to read a story by my friend Sandy Nichols, who is right now in New Mexico, planning to go see Georgia O'Keeffe's museum. So this is called Love Beyond the Space Between. Since you've been gone, I've traveled light years to a different planet. I watched another Dennis walk to his car in the Fiesta Market parking lot yesterday. He had red curly hair just like you. His red hair is graying, the way yours might look if you were still here. I saved your red curls when you were small to watch the change in color as you grew older. The small square envelopes in which I placed those treasures slipped away over the years, traveling to outer space with neither you nor me. What would we say if you were here? We'd speak of Ryan's phone call at 5:45 a.m. I heard the ring from my bedroom and determined I wouldn't answer unless it was Ryan. I always answered calls from you and your brother. After all, you are my flesh and blood, pride and joy. Remember how you used to call to wake Ryan up? I'd answer. Your cheery and wide awake voice saying, "Good morning." You called to make sure Ryan was awake so you both could meet your dad on time for work. Now Ryan calls me. He's awake early these days to make sure he gets himself and his daughters up. He worries in the morning. Did you? When I answered your calls, you never sounded worried. This time it's about Hannah changing schools. He wants to have a say in the decision, but doesn't know how. He didn't ask me what I thought, probably because he knew I'd tell him anyway. First of all, what does Hannah want? Well, you know, he says, after visiting with her mom, she thinks the change might be all right. You have the last say here, Rye, I tell him. So what do you think? Ryan needed you at that moment. I can just imagine you pushing your fingers through your kinky red hair and saying, "Don't worry so much, Rye. She'll be fine." Ryan must have heard you through the space between, because he immediately relaxed. "Okay," he said with a sigh that resonated through the lines and touched my soul. "Dennis, I'm here to tell you that Hannah is fine. We are all fine. But our lives lack the color that came from your dynamic manner and honesty, saying what's what with no bones about it. Yes, we're fine, but Dennis, I miss you." He was riding his motorcycle on Honey Road, and a truck hit him. And he landed right in front of a doctor's, retired doctor's home, who tried to revive him, of course. Okay, the next story is from Sandy. She has several in here, but this is the one I like. Raising Rockettes. The Rockettes were doing it before I was born. The old tap and kick routine. I had it down by the time I was 4 years old. Daddy wanted a Shirley Temple. He was lucky. He had two. Sisters with sausage curls and a will to please, we were dancing with our first steps. Cigarette in one hand, bourbon in the other, Daddy would stand next to the fireplace and announce to assembled guests that two young prima donnas had just arrived straight from Radio City Music Hall in New York and were on hand to entertain them this very evening. Char and I would come running down the hall and burst into the living room wearing our black patent leather tap shoes and pink ruffles. singing and shuffling to I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy or I'm looking over a four-leaf clover. Then we would jump right into our special rendition of It's a Sin to Tell a Lie. We took it in stride, believed it was what every girl child was expected to do, is entertain. We had a closet full of costumes and an excuse to wear lipstick and rouge. Weekly dance lessons were at Betty Merriweather's School of Dance on H Street in Eureka. Piano lessons were with Miss Weisenfelder, who owned a cat that could open the door. Every day we sang our whole repertoire as soon as we climbed into the back of the Plymouth for a ride across town. Evenings, Daddy romanced the saxophone, cradling it like a baby and swaying around the living room. It wasn't long before Char and I were playing clarinet and marching in a band. Saturday nights, we often went dinner dancing. Daddy taught us swing, the two-step, and the waltz, giving each of us a turn around the floor. Mom was included, but preferred to observe. We never made it to Broadway, but to this day, I can't sit still when the band begins to play. I wish we could go around, Daddy, just one more time. Thank you. And
you want to announce the next?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good. Nan, would you go next?
I'm switching.
Oh, okay.
Margaret didn't mention that Mary Lou Downing donated this lovely picture for the front of our book. It was just a wonderful coincidence that it fit perfectly. I'm going to read one of my pieces called Love Me, I'm a Writer. You may not understand me. I can be quiet and moody. Then I'll turn around and talk your ear off. I can't help it. I'm a writer. A writer needs to immerse herself in life's rhythms. If you are not moving to the beat of nature, I will shy away. When you're right in the middle of living, I'll want to join you there. When the unexpected happens, like a swarm of bees taking up residence in the front yard, or friends dropping by, I'm charged by life's unpredictability. But I also crave the security of ritual, which is why I get funny about little things you change without warning. I'm sitting outside near a water fountain with my page well lit by the sun. I hear the sound of water crashing down behind me, the hum of a motor and bees buzzing by. I feel a breeze gently blowing my face and spray from the fountain hitting me sporadically. Could you love all this with me? And then I'm going to read a piece by Jennifer Phelps called My Agenda. It's a perfect example of what happens when Margaret helps you find your voice. You want a poem? You want me to make it pretty? You want it chock full of vivid imagery, tactile sensation? You want me to paint you a picture with my words? Let me tell you something. I don't write them like that. I write them heavy and gritty so that you feel like you've something to digest after reading my words. Maybe you even feel a little disrupted. Mm-hmm. All the better. I want to tell you something that you have never heard before. I want you to be delighted that I have dared to write what you were afraid to think. And I like to believe that the echoes of my dreams and of my truths will resound in your head long after the flowery, fluffy ones devoid of substance have floated away on perfumed imaginary breezes.
Yeah. Colleen, will you read next, please?
I'm Colleen Warner, and this is Who Keeps Me Grounded. Okay, this is called Rite of Passage. I watched my father's last breaths as night fell gently over Los Angeles and the city lights were beginning to show. I stood looking at that final shutter, hoping there would be no more, that this would be the last of the breathing, bleeding, and his belligerence, the last of the angry nurses, drunken sister, medicated mom, and the doctor who could not say the word die. Silent in this hospital room, I inhaled his final exhalation, and with this action took him in. All of his responsibilities landed on me like an ill-fitting old coat, heavy, smelling like the sour mix of Vitalis, Johnny Walker, and Lucky Strike. Too big, too wrong. I watched as my father's body was wheeled down the hallway. A small gust of air blew off the sheet and exposed the mottled green blues of the tag toe. I watched as his body entered the elevator, knowing that when the door closed on his remains, it would also close on my innocence. In minutes following the end of his coma, I went from studious adolescent to responsible woman, from the back seat to the driver's seat. His death was both a great relief and unwieldy burden. I stood strong and in charge. I said no to the autopsy, yes to the organ donation. Called and comforted the relatives, got my mother her Valium and my sister her bourbon. Then I drove home slowly, ready for my new life. And now I'm going to read another Sandy Nichols piece that I like the best, the Home Depot. Forklifts, staccato voices beeping, slide along on silent wheels, moving up one aisle, down another, we piece together rooms like puzzles. A pace behind, I notice your legs, how they bulge at the calf, pale skin covered with fine dark hair. I want to reach up under your shirt, run my fingers along your back, feel the welts, no longer visible, yet etched in your mind, the sting of cuts, a shirt rubbing against raw skin. Alaskan days that never ended, trailing a mother who followed the pipeline, pinned flowers in her hair and forgot to come home. Dark winters of pale negatives forever engraved, running away, lash of a belt, foster homes. Time has dissipated fears. Still I sense a rippling along your spine when I step too near. Detect your desire to see the periphery, the way a feral cat crouches just outside the circle of light. I want to give you something ordinary. Wednesdays, garden roses, regular rhythms, cows moving from barn to field. Instead, I inspect copper tubing, tiles cured in the Mexican sun, doors, walls of doors, windows we don't need.
Virginia, would you read next, please?
Thank you. My name is Regina Ramos Hooker. This first one is called Locked Up. The hollow sound of walking on waxed floors down long hallways through heavy clanking doors. My prison is not your prison, but we all have one. Some prisoners, when at last released from their humiliation, four pairs of underwear weekly and no right to wash them. Some prisoners, when at last released from their humiliation, meals at 5, 10, and 4, and if no money, no snacks. Some prisoners, when at last released from their humiliation, bend, spread your cheeks, and cough. Some prisoners become, in the midst of their hardship, in the midst of their surrender, saints. What I know about community, what I know about strength, I learn most of it from them. My prison, in my prison, I deny myself. I deprive myself. I tease myself with whispers of hope, then violently take down my heart. In my prison, every wisdom is erased. The walls of my cell are blank at the end of the day. I try to watch the full moon through my tiny window. I see it for a moment before it passes. That is the gift. This one's called Water is Life. I remember the flamingos on Lake Nakuru lifting off the water in waves of wing, pink on top, black underneath, They fly, pink black, pink black, pink black. They erupt off the water in waves of wing. There's a cement platform with colonnades a short distance from the shore. This is where Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of post-colonial Kenya, sat majestically on Sunday mornings and spoke to his people via radio broadcast. In a slow and dignified cadence, he said, "My fellow countrymen, please enjoy the beauty of your nation and take pride in your own appearance. I don't want any man, woman, or child in rags." I imagine Mzee Kenyatta sitting there 30 years after his passing, still speaking to his people. Kenyans are known for their modest and fastidious dress. Clothes are always freshly laundered and pressed. Once in a Kenyan village, I tried to do my laundry. While lazily scrubbing my clothes with a bar of soap and a blue plastic tub of hot water, my friend Naomi said, "Please let me do it. This is my strength, and I cannot bear to see laundry done badly." She calmly scrubbed my slacks and t-shirts with so much muscle that I thought she might wear a hole in them. Then she rinsed them in another tub of warm water and wrung each piece out with her mighty hands. Finally, standing in a wide stance with both knees bent, she looked like an Olympic discus thrower, only much, much prettier. She twirled each article of clothing in faster circles until the excess water spun out. Then she hung the clothing on the line to dry quickly in the midday sun. A village day is separated by tasks that have to do with water. Water is heated in a pan on the Coleman gas stove for washing hands and face in the morning. Water in a pan is heated over coals for cooking and dishwater. Water is heated for bathing and so on. Each task requires attention and presence. Rest follows each task. The day stretches out in an orderly and predictable way. Beyond the village is the savanna with its sparse acacia. There, zebras and gazelles drink together quietly at the waterhole. There's a peace to the quiet, an elemental power to the searing sun, the billowing clouds, the red clay, the water of life. Time expands in this slowly paced world of wide open spaces. Time is relative. This could be yesterday, or Kenyatta's time, or ancient history.
Ooh. Terry, would you read?
Sure. Thanks.
My name is Terry Robbins. I'm going to read a couple of pieces from women that I've written with in writing circle. Let's see, what were those page numbers? This one is by Susan Weinstein. Oh, I had to pick a long one. The history of my hair. The history of my hair begins with my round, bald baby head, then light brown hair that came in thin and wavy. I inherited my hair from my grandmother on my father's side, thick, dark hair with waves I could not control. For a long time, I wore my hair long, down to my waist. It was heavy with a braid that was long and bulky. I couldn't wear it up. I tried an elegant updo and felt myself start to topple over backwards. I wore hair scarves. I wore scarves in my hair and clipped it back. My dad used to trim my hair and shape the ends. Then one day in Seattle, he lost his focus. He cut it randomly, and my hair lost the will to curl on its own. It hung down in sad, shocked strands. I put on a knitted hat, and Mom and I went to a very expensive boutique in the Stauffer Madison Hotel on the recommendation of a woman named Michelle. She called her hairdresser, Samir, declaring it a hair emergency. We panicked, not caring about the cost. Samir's sister, Odette, shampooed my hair, commenting on its thickness, but her hair was thicker, curlier, and had burgundy highlights. Samir started to comb and cut, and as he shaped it, the waves and curls returned. He said it would take about 3 haircuts and about 4 months to fully recover and charged $40. Even though it seemed like a lot in 1999, we were expecting it to be more because it was in a fancy hotel. Dad felt so bad that when we got back to the room, he cried. Later, he took credit for the improved style of my hair. Thanks to me, you look great, he said. The hair crisis had been averted. As I look back on it now, he was right. I do look better with a shorter cut. During those precious weeks before my father passed away, we reminisced. He reminded me that I am the one in the family who looks like him and reached out to touch my hair. Mm-hmm. I remember when her father died. So, needing a change that only retail therapy or a haircut could provide, I had my hair cut short last year. I don't think I'll grow it long again. It just isn't practical. I've seen a few gray hairs that speak their piece by sticking straight up or by being wispy. I don't pull them out or color them. I've earned those gray hairs, and so they stay. Yeah. I should have pre-read these so I could have emotion separated.
You're doing fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, appreciate it.
There we go. What page was that? Can't remember what page was on.
What are you looking for?
Are you looking for a particular one?
Yeah, I was. I'll just read one for Marie Galetta.
Okay.
Bones. Secretly, I've been imagining people without their skin. In fact, without their muscles, blood, organs, and nerves, too. I've been imagining what they would look like if they were only bone. I've been studying bones in anatomy class, and it seems to me they have a lot to say. They are our roots, the bare base of us, the foundation upon which we stand. They hold our history. Imagining people as only bone has proved an amusing pastime. Last night while watching TV, I was jolted into a fit of laughter. I yelled to my husband, "Do you know that the captain has a hole in his skull right between his eyebrows? Wouldn't it be funny if we could see it? He has a tail, too. The Cossack's bone looks exactly like a tail attached to the bottom of the sacrum and even moves when you sit." We take so much care with our appearances in this culture, in so many cultures for that matter. What we look like on the outside is supposed to be such a representation of who we are, but it's just the superficial portion, a small part, and certainly not the most important part. Even tribal cultures use tattoos and piercings to illustrate their status within the tribe. Sometimes I wonder how much people realize that if you stripped away our own physical outsides, we're all pretty much the same. Of course, some are bigger or smaller, and there are boys' and girls' bones. But we all have 22 bones in our skull, 8 cranial and 14 facial, 206 bones in the body, and they are all connected in exactly the same way.
Well, I think we could do one more go-round with our time. And perhaps if we each read one, would that be okay? You're going to slip off? Okay. We'll just do one more go-round in the same order and just read one piece. And this is another piece I wrote called "And Still I Write." And still I write about sheets of white clouds billowing across a cornflower blue canvas sky. I still write about an old pine tree, silhouetted against an aqua blue evening, its leaves tinged with emerald green, mango yellow, and fluorescent silver. And still I write about my Africa, a slanted white remnant left over from the wild yearnings of an Eastern European wish list. I still write about a mysterious African savanna, spotted with sage green veldbos and echoing with a lion's roar that wakes me from my early morning mind. I still write about the slate gray elephants swaying, their majestic torsos filling my lens while they gather their offspring and stare at me through watchful eyes. And still, I write about the brick chimneys spewing bone-filled smoke choking up the lungs. I still write about an efficient war machine with trains running on time. I write about railroad tracks where suitcases and shoes are left behind to tell the burning stories. And still, I write about the elixir of words that promise to transform base metal into liquid gold. I still write about poetry and its enchanting glow when held up to the sweet smell of a jasmine sunset. I still write about the California coastline holding urgent promises of opalescent calla lilies and eucalyptus trees whose long branches ache to gather up the sky. And I write about the ambiguity in a story about a father and a monkey and a fascination with a lonely voice singing quela under the street lamp. Now I write about a sea change, a complicated voyage that continues to offer a myriad of ocean grottos to open me to yet another new life. I write about those precious moments. I write because it is what I know to do. Open the notebook, find a page that loves freedom, unclip the pen from its headpiece, and scratch out a story, one word following another. And still I write, coaxing that subterranean treasure chest to float back up to the surface, bringing with it those fierce whispers that beg to see the light of day. Okay.
Okay. I don't want you to get the wrong impression. There are gentlemen in our writing group. I'm going to read a piece by Robert Kennedy called Last Will and Testament. I cannot bargain with the calendar. When death comes, I won't fear drowning in the indigo of darkness, for without the robe of darkness, pure light would have no character. I want to enter its dark cosmos with the same curiosity I now use unsparingly on a newly minted fawn or the mergansers and wood ducks that jostle for navigation rights on our pond. I want to believe time is a mirage, that life is just a note in the never-ending music of the cosmos, and death is only the necessary silence between the notes. I live my note proudly and loudly. I've been immortal thus far, and so far can't be undone. I won't moan fearfully in my bed. I'll give fear a back rub and send him off to sleep. I will be ready, passport in hand. I don't want to linger long at the border. When death comes, I bequeath my sorrows and regrets, large as houseboats, to those who need them to justify their existence. So, too, shall I leave all those important things now needing a microscope to even exist. But before death comes, I want to say goodbye to the moon who whispered me to sleep each night, to the sun whose capriciousness kept me and the seasons guessing, to the faithful trees whose leaves, like my tears, fell with the passing of summers and stood by me naked through the winters, to all the creatures great and small whose poetry I never knew. When I lie in the grass learning little by little to love poetry in all things, to find my place in this living world, I don't want to leave only having been a tourist. I want to tell my critic, don't bother me, I've just been born.
I have another one that I thought Nan was going to read from Robert Kennedy, and it's so appropriate for this particular setting. It's called meditation. I'm trying to learn to meditate. The first job, sitting still. Then trying to observe my mind with my mind. But it wants to sleep. I start to nod off. Stop! Meditate! Okay, okay. But my mind crawls away. It's over there picking berries. Stop! Come back. Sit with me and meditate. Meditate! Such a word. Such a word. What's its etymology? Med, medium, medieval, medical, etate. Oh, stop, just meditate. Like the book says, I try the lotus position. It hurts. I focus on the pain. How, this won't work. All I can think of is lunch. Broiled salmon, mango salsa, leeks, garlic, mashed potatoes. I want to grab my mind and shake it. My legs hurt, my back hurts. Can meditation really be good for old people? I try meditating while walking, but I fall over because I occasionally keep one foot in the air too long. I try to focus on sadness, my mother dying, my father's death, my brother's death. That hurts too. Is meditation all about pain? I try to focus on the sense of smell, coffee brewing. I wonder, who picked the beans? How much was he paid? Does he worry about taxes? That's the best I can do. Time to stop now. Coffee's done.
I was trying to figure out which one to read, and it's hard because there's so many good ones. I think that I'm going to read this one, Turbans and Wigs by Jane Paul. We sit in a huge waiting room, women in turbans and wigs, men all in baseball caps. No one talks. Chatting is inappropriate, as in a chapel. My three-year-old son waits on my lap, our thick curly hair a testament to being the loved ones. My brother goes with a brusque nurse as he is weighed, and he turns his head, doesn't want to know how many pounds the tumor devoured this week. In the car home, his hat on his lap, odd tufts of gray hair stick out at odd angles. He's refused to shave it. Now I turn away and try to focus on the road.
Terry, would you read one more? Thank you.
I know what page number is on there. This one is called A Childhood Vacation by Jessica Rothman Connolly. I only remember one formal vacation during my childhood. I am sure we took others, but this one stands out. I'm not sure why it left such a strong impression. Maybe it was the trip up the California coast, the car, the camping, or the final destination, San Francisco. Most people, normal people, go on vacation in the family station wagon. At least in the 60s, it was the family station wagon. Now it would be the minivan or the SUV, which is just a glorified station wagon with four-wheel drive and a tendency to roll over if you take the corner too fast. Anyway, of course, we did not have a family station wagon. We were not a normal family. I was always aware of that. My mom was a single mom. They did not even have a term for it then. It was so out of the norm. Anyway, getting back to the point, the car we used on this vacation was a huge, old, at least 10 years old at the time, dirty white Lincoln Town Car that had back doors which opened toward the front. And it had a trunk so big you really didn't need it to be a station wagon. Looking back, I think we must have looked quite comical dragging our old dusty tent and sleeping bags out of that big boat, but it was fun. It was magical to be by the slow-moving, sparkling river, getting my feet wet in the too cold water, standing there in the aqua blue two-piece bathing suit my mother bought me just for the vacation. Anyway, our family vacation was still a vacation from the city, and the stress of being 10, it was a vacation in the wilderness of my mind.
Yeah. Thank you all for reading. That was great. Shall we write some? I have some paper that I'm happy to hand out, and I have pens. The trick is going to be...
I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to find myself. Here we go. This is great.
Yeah.
There. It's going to be, if you have something to press on, yeah, would you do it?
hand it around, and if you need some, I'm happy to loan this book if you need something to press on. Uh-huh. And I have another book in here, I think. Yeah. I'm happy to loan this to someone who might need something to press on as well. And then I have a bag of pens. If you don't have a pen, feel free to take one of these. Do you have one? Yeah,
thank you.
Of course. Pen? Pen? Of course. Do you need this?
No, we've got
that. Bye, Clover.
Thank you so much for
listening.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
I'm
sorry.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, yeah.
Bye. Thanks for coming. Yeah, and thank you for bringing Clover. Someday we've got to spend time together.
Thank you.
Okay. So, this is, for those of you who've not written in this way before, I'll give a jump off line. And we'll write for about 10 minutes. I'm going to give two jump-off lines tonight, so I'm going to let you choose either or both.
Margaret, explain what a jump-off line is for people
that might not. Would you like to explain?
Oh. Go ahead. A jump-off line is just a starter line, and then you can go there where, however you want after that.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, just go. Just jump. No editor. I remember. I don't remember. I remember, I don't remember. Either or both. I remember, I don't remember. Ooh, you have a not good pen. Yes, you do. Let me get that.
Oh, dear.
Do you need
some
pen?
I'll get
let me check and make sure we have a decent pen for you. Oh, dear. This looks a lot better. Was that one a bad one?
Okay. That looks
So begin to wind up. Bring it to a kind of natural conclusion. So, who'd like to read? Who'd like to just jump in and start?
I would.
Great. Ellen?
Yeah.
Great.
I remember the bright sun flashing like jewels off the deep blue and turquoise waters. I was sitting under the coconut tree savoring the fresh juice it had to share once my dad had chopped the top off with his machete. I remember how sweet, light, and thirst-quenching the milk was after running on the hot, white sand chasing my brother and sister in a game of some sort. I enjoyed each sip knowing that when I was done, the best part of the coconut would be next, the soft, supple coconut meat. This was a young coconut, the hull silk green, which meant that the flesh would be easy to peel out to eat. I hurried to finish the juice. We had to drink them often so we didn't get sick from too much sun. Now the best part. I run out to the salty ocean water and plop my young butt down in the gentle, soft waves, peel out a big chunk of the soft coconut and dip it in the ocean's water. Then I gloriously and voraciously pop it in my mouth. Yum. The combination of salt water on the coconut was my idea of the best snack in the world.
Any recall for Ellen? Any line or image that grabbed you?
Now the best part, I plopped my young butt in the cold water and dipped that soft meat in that salt water.
And the coconut meat mixed with the salt was my idea for the snack after.
The best part. The subtle... The meat, how you describe the coconut meat, the adjectives that I just can't call them up right now. But
the soft, supple coconut meat.
The soft, supple coconut meat, yeah. And chopping off the top with a machete.
We had to drink a lot of it because of the heat.
Okay, anyone else? To read. Great. Tell us your name again.
Michelle.
Michelle, thanks.
I don't remember a time when my fingernails have been clean. Well, perhaps I do, but it was a while ago. These days, my gardening career has taken a lot of time I would otherwise be spending doing nothing, or very little. I prefer it this way, actually. There was a time not too long ago when I could sit still for a long time. Not any longer. Now I have adult onset deficit disorder. Like a cat on a hot tin roof, I find myself unable to sit still for very long. I wonder when I'll let myself relax a little, go back more to the way I used to be. But I'll still be gardening, I can imagine. Gardening and holding space for others who've been too timid until now to take ownership of their gardens. Like any chore too large for one person alone, a garden can become daunting for the many single people in our communities. And yet, when they come together, so much work can be done. Garden Fridays. Let's institute a local phenomenon. Pizza and gardens on Fridays.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember a time when my fingernails, when I didn't have dirt under my fingernails, or my fingernails are clean, or...
I used to sit around a lot. Now I have adult onset
deficit. Yeah.
can't sit still.
There are care gardens for single people who... What was the rest of that line?
Find it daunting to
find... Oh, yeah. Find it daunting to garden alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fridays, pizza and gardening.
Yeah. The startup phenomenon.
Thank you. Who's next?
I'll do something different.
Okay. Yay. Would you tell us your name?
Betty.
Good. Betty. Thank you.
I remember so many things that happened long ago, 50 years, 60 years, even 75 years. Mm-hmm. Earliest memory, a feeling of jealousy as I saw my brother lifted onto the swing that hung in the doorway. My swing, I thought. But what was this strange, dark feeling, sharp, out of nowhere? I remember it to this day. I don't remember what it was I did yesterday and at what time. This woman I met, and 10 minutes later, what is her name? Ah, short-term memory, they say, the first to go. But almost every moment of my life from childhood on is there for me to bring to light, to pick and choose. Mm. Was yesterday so important, or today?
It was this dark, sharp feeling that I can still recall. My brother in my swing in the doorway. I thought it was my swing.
Whew. I can remember things 50 years ago, 60, even 75 years.
But not so much yesterday. The person I met 10 minutes ago.
Is it that important? Mm-hmm. Yesterday? Today? Thank you, Betty. Anyone else?
I will.
Good.
I remember what the grass looked like, what it felt like, soft and sometimes damp. When the rain came, it really came like a bolt of lightning, which brought with it beautiful rain. Rain felt cleansing, like all the old cobwebs you'd been carrying around were gone in the most fresh and cleansing way. You could breathe now, breathe in the fresh and clean air and the smells from the soil that only rain can bring. The smells were dark and luscious and earthy. I loved that smell. It went into very deep places in me, into the place from which imagination comes, like those places where you realize that this ordinary door at the back of the closet could take you into these incredible worlds, worlds of magic and alchemy, where you could make things happen that were difficult to do in the ordinary world on the other side of the door. Magic worlds that touch the soul, that touch places from which creativity sprang. These worlds were rich. You never really wanted to leave, never go back to that harsher, more rigid world where people snarled and had these very hard looks, looks that pierced the soul, that made you close down, that made you feel not very important or interesting, and really it made you feel rather stupid.
Thank you, Kathleen. Yeah. That back door in the closet that took you to a magical world.
Parts in the beginning about the rain. Mm-hmm. The dark, luscious, and earthy spirit.
Yeah, that dark. Maybe, we'll, yeah. Thank you. That's okay.
Yeah, I really like the part where you didn't want to go back to the ordinary world. It's just so much nicer there.
And all the magical creativity and the inspiration and the rain, the whole description of the rain.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else? Great, Carl. If you weren't going to offer yourself, I was going to invite you.
Carl.
Carl, thanks.
We called this storm, and I thought it was interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It up on the rain. I don't remember whether I ever knew what was going on. Afterward, it seemed as if there must have been a glimmer of comprehension, but it was too faint to register at the time. The wind blew, the sky darkened, all hell broke loose in the trees, and I ran everywhere but for cover. I loved it, the wild blood in my arms and legs, the breath of fire, the vision of ecstasy that threw off all restraint, marveled at the symphony in full crescendo in my feet, my hands, my eyes, wide and wanting more, more of the roaring, the bending, the flashing, and finally, the rain.
Ooh. I ran out.
Everywhere except for cover.
I loved it.
That was an ecstasy.
I ran everywhere except for cover. Oh, thank you. Jim, would you like to read?
Okay. It's real short.
Oh.
I don't remember if the moon was out that night. All the city lights bouncing off the store windows mingled with your tender smile.
Oh. Oh. Could we hear that again, please?
Sure. I don't remember if the moon was out that night. All the city lights bouncing off the store windows mingled with your tender smile.
Very nice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for.
Yeah. Is there anyone else before we wind up who hasn't read who'd still like to? Great. Would you tell us your name?
Royce.
Oh, great.
The Dark Writing, I Remember, by Lloyd Serone. I remember I used to write. I hate to write. I hate to write because I have to read. I remember I used to read. I hate to read because I have to understand. I remember I used to understand. I hate to understand because I have to write about what I understand. I think I will not remember.
Oh! Oh, God. I hate to remember. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, shall we wrap it up? Unless there's someone else who's itching to read. Then, no. Well, thank you so much for inviting us tonight. It was just fantastic. It was just a perfect atmosphere for us. And
so
really
much.
Appreciate it.
And thank you to all the readers. That was really, it was a great evening. I mean, I really enjoyed it. That's a great collection. Thank you so much.
Thank you.